chanter entre nous, bravo. Et bienvenue à la mer Salish du Sud. Welcome at the Sea Salish of the South. I'm not sure that's how you say it in French, but welcome everybody. And let's just be honest here, there are a couple of times you don't want to go next, okay? For example, if you're the pastor at an auction and it's a society to preserve small kittens or something, after that feel-good weepy video plays, you know, on the multiple screens in a ballroom that's been darkened intentionally to loosen up the pockets of the sleepy auction goers who've been made susceptible to disorganized pickpocketing through a plan for a combination of slightly rich blood alcohol and a particular babysitter beer. Or, as here, after a display of moral righteousness and vigorous optimism by a formidable and preternaturally attractive group of young people. So I would say beware the power of high schoolers armed with facts to cajole, hound, and will change an otherwise indifferent adult world. I remember actually Al Franken when he was running for Senate campaign and you're taking the stage after one of those aforementioned soft factory videos was focused, I think, on a rather scoldy group of high schoolers who had been telling us adults how we really messed up the plan. And he paused as the lights came on and people were dabbing their eyes and he was trying to figure out what to say, anything, some segue, as people were sort of guiltily shuffling in their chairs. And the thing he came up with, which is the thing that was on all the adults' minds, was, we're all going to hell. But I think with these ambassadors, we're going to do better than that. But as a concerned citizen who frankly is looking for a little less hope, maybe, which worked pretty well here, you know, 6 years ago in this country, and a lot more action now, in a country that seems to be fueled and simultaneously paralyzed by fear and misinformation, these young people's leadership and vision, technical prowess, and optimism is what we're all looking for. What remarkable communicators these kids are. Of both science and vision, the artistic and the psychological, the emotional and the valuable. Rigor, relevance, and relationships. They have the data, the rigor. They have the right data, the relevant data. But as has been said by many people, the data themselves don't trigger action. Data has to have a constituency. And that's for all you scientists, even in the back of the room, to hear. Someone has to care enough about your facts that they'll take them to help change the status quo. And it's hard to change institutions, markets, or a mere mortal over 45, or 55, 58. But I also have to think just preliminarily about how I'm placed in this keynote slot, smushed as I am against these young leaders, up against late Davis, who has the best job on earth, and who I understand is being underwritten by the wonderful Paul J. Allen Foundation, which got me to thinking, how do you get underwritten? I asked the secretary, and I don't know that I'm being underwritten. And then tomorrow there's the keynote is Dr. Robert Lackey, who will probably use my remarks actually as Exhibit A, which is how confused policymakers can get when they talk about science. Perhaps my guilt is one of his four realities circumscribed in the same thing he's going to talk about tomorrow. We'll see. And if I'm sounding a little bit sheepish, it's because I've done my diligence on Dr. Lackey. And I found his 2011 plenary address in the 141st annual meeting of the American Fisheries Society. And can I just say that one more time? The 141st annual meeting? Can we have a show of hands of our society members here in the AFS? I'm not new, we've been around since 9 years after the Civil War. But, you know, we get grief at the partnership for not having to save you to sound in 7 years. You guys have been at it for a long time. Not that, I do understand that fisheries collapse is not because of science, but probably politics. But his talk was called Science, a Beacon of Reality, where he describes the world of politics and policy, which is my world, which is why I'm the token policy person up here, as, quote, a landscape populated by delusional bureaucratic cheerleaders, overrun with feel-good politicians, and infested with very well-funded policy advocates. And so before I confidently move on to my deliriously enthusiastic hallucinogenic Pollyanna policy pontification, I thought that I would do something that will give you a bit of a segue from the last speakers, which is to sort of do something that is not your typical science conference fair, to be sure. Your all's idea of good times to have a poster session with alcohol, like at this, right? But, you know, it's lunchtime, so why don't we just have a little fun? And I'm going to do what sort of is the opposite of those kids, is to be sort of slightly ridiculous, amateurish, and maybe unattractive, and probably quite inappropriate, Tracy, who asked me to speak, by giving you some science and policy this way. The UNIPCC was quite cranky. They tell us that the world is in a tanky. The planet is gonna get warmer by the hour, and the pH in the ocean's getting sour. They say that carbonic acid's getting flummoxed, and Yosemite orcas got empty stomachs. They say the cushy Western nations, they've been napping, while the waves upon the Maldives, they've been laughing. Remember when BP and the MMS had been dining, and the alley-oops and frivolop had been whining? This talk has really gotten me to wonder what there's left to say now that those kids stole my thunder. So, doing alone in our cars, let's take a carbon holiday. For solutions, you've got to pay, old chum. Let's pay for a greener way. I wish you had some wine to make this less ridiculous, or at least a band. Let's make our mind up to do as that kid planned it. When we leave, let's all take transit. So, I think that's enough. Good question. My big hope is that science conferences aren't where jokes go to die. So I thought that was a way to do it. It's like amusing. So the name of this free talk is The Mobius Strip of Science and Policy and Ecosystem Recovery, which probably has me way out of a scientific limb. I'm an English major from Berkeley. Okay, we take poetic license, but seriously, there's a wire. Some of you might also say we never confuse a good story with the facts, and so let me just get this last thing out here and stop joking, which makes me admit, usually in big groups like this, that early on in my criminal defense work, I was in front of a jury box and said with great vehemence and conviction while pointing to the defendant, quote, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my client, Mr. Guilty." So, that's why I agreed with my mistake, so you'll excuse me. But back to the Mobius Strip. You all know what a Mobius Strip is. It's a two-dimensional surface with one side. It can be constructed in three dimensions as follows. Take a rectangular strip of paper, join the two ends of the strip together so that it has a 180-degree twist in it. It's now it's possible to start at a point A on the surface and trace out a path that passes through the point which is apparently on the other side of the surface from A. And because this title of this talk was requested by the Secretariat of the conference before the aforesaid talk had been fully actualized, and because of its required brevity, it's pretty obvious that if this is the university ecosystem recovery, as this analogy suggests, then a whole lot was left out. It would be on circulation on that strip. And I think that's where we are on day one of this gathering. This is the thread that is winding its way through this conference. An agreement or an understanding that there's a requirement to collaborate between the scientific, both biophysical and social communities, and the policy decision makers, in whose absence, to quote Dr. Wellman, we find ourselves with scientific research that's not relevant to decision makers, or decisions made without the support of the scientific community, which is a place no one here wants to be. We all recognize there is, in this sense, and among this group, I hope, of scientists, or at least in the mind of this delusional policymaker, one nature, homeland security and convenience of the 49th parallel, notwithstanding, to you Canadians. And the pulling out of science, or policy, or politics, or people, or art, or history, or love, or desire, economics, traditional knowledge, or memory, or especially in the future, is a human construct, an unnatural reductionist approach to understanding the facts on the ground, and then by extension what needs to be understood in order to build a resilience into the system, this great Salish Sea writ large. We recognize we are all people of the same Salish Sea, but neither north nor south, though, has a unified definition of the same. It is a place. It's an idea. It's an ideal. It's a future, and it's the sum of its historic parts. It's a chemical and biological system that churns on with or without our inputs and protections. It's the economic engine of the northeastern part of the Pacific Rim, a source of communal pride. It's what attracts and keeps the right brain economy and keeps our left brain sane. It's a rallying cry. It's a spiritual hollow ground from the snow caps to the white caps, from Port Townsend to Tsawwassen, from Vancouver to Seattle. It's the unbelievable 250-foot breaking waves, if I have my facts correct, in the underwater river of the Juan de Fuca Canyon. Big as the Columbia and Amazon systems combined, flowing uphill into the Salish Sea, full of carbon. It's, as an environmental educator friend of mine once said, there are few places that are so lovely, so tempered, so well-watered, so civil, so wealthy, so educated, and so new. It's remote. Gettysburg in America gets more visitors in a busy weekend than the 500,000-acre North Cascades National Park will get in a year. And it's wet. Vancouver Island, the largest island on the West Coast of North America, holds the record for the wettest place in North America. And on this sunny day, I don't know if I dare say this, but let's say the stat out loud, 261.8 inches, or an astounding, more astounding, 665 millimeters of rain. And that's why Uncle Sam ain't going metric, I can tell you that, it just sounds good. And in terms of its future, the population is only going to grow a lot. It's the quantifiable, it's the stats on the pH, the DO, the length of the coastline, the yearly snowpack, but it's also the ineffable, the value of sharing these waters with the totemic and endangered orca and chinook, the value of softening the bulkhead for the sake of a small forage fish, or the value of the sunrise on Mount Baker, Mount Kulshan. But it is, in fact, also a dumping ground, the background, the place we take for granted, the backdrop for short-term thinking, the broken structure of the relationships, as Gary Nabong argues, that creates the problems. It's the receiving waters of all the waters brought by gravity through the basin from your house, from our house, the soup that comes from waking up to a modern North American morning and simply going about our lives. It's complex and it's complicated and it's difficult in 2014 to figure out what the fix is, what the it is that's going to get it done. And their lists, their top tens, do this, don't do that, vote for her, buy that product, stop buying stuff, stop immigration, get kids outside, get out of your car, fund transit, enforce regulations, fully fund voluntary incentives. It's science, it's policy, it's the primacy of cheap energy, it's equity and justice, and our obligations to the end arrive. It's the underlying philosophies upon which we build our lives and which we therefore want to see reflected in our government. Or maybe we just want to see the government dismembered. It's demographics and pernicious incentives. It's treaty rights and property rights. It's facts that the citizenry don't buy while their values trump the best available science. And the answer is, in fact, all of the above, as we all try to solve our way toward a durable prosperity, managing the ecosystem with people at the center. And it's not easy. It's an ongoing, for lack of a better word, negotiation. The process by which people with conflicting interests determine how they're going to allocate resources and work together in the future, for the future, but also in the moment. The broad work that we're engaged with at the Puget Sound Partnership, the state agency charged with overseeing the restoration and protection of Puget Sound by 2020, which just our mission will surely raise some rhetorical red flags with the scientists in this ballroom, is historically grounded in a narrative that typically uses the signing of the Treaty of Point Elliott in 1855 as its ecological, demographic, social, psychosocial, and spiritual baseline. This narrative, of course, is not everyone's starting point, but it serves as a proxy often to describe a simpler time before European settlement and the attendant ecological and social alteration. Some might say progress, some decimation. Whatever your point of view is, it's fair to say that the ecoregion has been significantly altered. And although the tribes have been here for at least 10,000 years, as early as the mid-1800s, not long after the white man dropped anchor on Altai Beach in 1851, the Washington territorial governments passed laws to prevent sawdust dumping in rivers around mills to protect salmon habitat. In the 1920s, shellfish growers set up alarms over pollution from the same industry. And from 1945 to 1970, the state created agencies and statutes to address issues of industrial toxic waste, boosted then, of course, in 1972 by the Clean Water Act. What has happened since then? Whoops, sorry. I don't know how to do that. What happened since then has been a three-decade cascade of Puget Sound water quality initiatives, species and site-specific recovery plans. Thank you, dear. Under 58, she is. shoreline management schemes and a proliferation of agencies, local, federal, tribal, all with pieces of the ecosystem management in their charge, creating a very complex, overlapping, and most importantly, uncoordinated labyrinthine system where no one was ultimately charged with asking a couple of key questions nor holding people accountable. And the questions are very simple. What do we mean when we say saving Puget Sound? From what and whom? And what is a healthy Puget Sound? Who cares? Who says? Who's framing? Who's scale? What will he have to give and what can we hope to get? What does all of this work done in all of these silos add up to for the Sound? And if it doesn't add up, why not and how can we do better? The two prior iterations of the Puget Sound Partnership beginning in the 80s significantly failed to capture fully two central ideas that would change how we would organize ourselves and what we would focus on. First, we needed to broaden our reach of the marine environment from beyond this estuary, the second largest in the United States. But if we were to save the Sound, so we expanded the range from the snowcaps to the whitecaps, which led to the addition of the second and most fundamental revision to this complex work. In this third iteration, the authorizing legislation simply says, we must ensure a thriving natural system that exists in harmony with a vibrant economy. Enter people. Prior to this, we weren't worrying about the entire weapon's life, just pieces of it, and you don't have to be John Muir or Chief Seattle to know that when one tugs at a single thing in nature, she finds it attached to the world. We need as a region to decide what we value, what we'll give up, what the trade-offs look like, what our vision for the future looks like. This is a negotiation across cultures, across time, and across scales. The ecologist scale is large, extracted, abstracted. The biologist seeks patterns to make the system comprehensible, standardized, predictable, manageable. The tools of the trade are math and graphs, experimentation, charts, which are used as telescope up and down and across space and time to focus the mind around statistical trends and the essential forces at play at scale. The anthropologist, environmental sociologist scale, on the other hand, is finer, and their work is not about predictability, but rather how meaning and practice interact with larger issues, about why people feel a particular way, about the shared truth of the people, the political and social ecology in the landscape. How do we muster an answer from this, especially when government is typically, and by its nature, risk-averse and drawn to the expedient? I, like all of you, have a social, environmental, like you could say, crypto-fascist history. I can tell you more than you want to know about my California grandfather, who was a cattleman, quarryman, riprapper, dam builder, road builder, dredger. What he and the rest of his, what I call the geography of hope generation, accomplished, they did not just with impunity, but with great pride, especially in what Tim Egan calls the country's aggressive adolescence. In a time when there were no alternatives, no understanding or earthly reason not to bulk up, hunker down, and make Mother Nature better through a combination of revetments and seawalls and concrete and logging. The only thing he didn't do was timber mining, which I always feel like this is an A meeting where I can say my name is Martha and I'm an environmental train wreck by birth. But I have a brother now who's a farmer and a winemaker in California, and he can't drive his tractor over Blue Line Creek or Pound Small irrigation pond without a permit or a tent. It's too obvious to say that the scale on which my grandfather worked would not be allowed today. My fifth generation California brother's ability to alter the landscape is constricted by laws and regulations which really can't be understood without reference to the past. That was then, and this is now. Now part of the nature of my post as chair of the council to the Puget Sound Partnership is to be a generalist. In situations I find myself immersed in the moment, in the whipsaw of the small and the mighty, in the minutiae of the science of the drift cell, of the noxious weed here, the threatened upland bird habitat there, the economic development plan of the county over yonder and the budget cut for lack of enforcement, to the very real issue of talking convincingly about water scarcity in this very rainy place. One minute I'm having breakfast with a tribal elder and an afternoon snorkel with a group of biologists, trying to understand, as I think we all are, what the big picture is, where the large levers are, where the game changers lie, and how to organize and shift the state at the local level, while keeping the big picture first and foremost out into an unknowable future. Understanding, as we always say, that democracy can't be a vicarious experience. It's communal. That's how we're going to get this work done across opinions, across parties, across communities, industries, and governments. I've come to better understand that there are no ultimate solutions, no policy that is permanently perfect, that we need to adaptively manage our way, and that while these Manichaean frames rarely bear fruit, we as Americans, at least, have at our historic center a tradition of argument that doesn't just inform our national character, it really animates it fundamentally. This is no less so here in the West, where the traditional interface between the people and the federal government, beginning with our interaction on public lands, gives us a familiarity with this give and take, that Nevada bad boy, cowboy, tax, scoff law, racist, Clive Bundy, notwithstanding. But of articulating our respective interests, our identity vis-a-vis the land, whether we're a first-generation farmer or a first-generation asthmatic immigrant school kid in the inner city, we all have a stake at this table. But the overarching issues intrude, and I might describe the Nevada's issue perhaps in an unorthodox manner by recapitulating what I said 3 years ago at the closing of the Salish Sea Conference, that if nature is humanity's landlord, we've been getting a rocking great deal on rent and utilities, and business as usual might be a thing of the past. That might be hard science. And now what? Maybe that's social science. Has been alluded to already today. We know that the UN estimates the world past 7 billion people. And understanding that in the past 50 years the global population has more than doubled, we have to ask ourselves, can we get to 9 billion people by 2042 without regrets? Is it the sheer number of us, or where populations agglomerate like cluster bombs? Does consumption trump population in terms of stressors? As someone, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who said this funny, sort of sad thing, 9 billion vegan monks would be a very different world than the one we're going to have. And I also heard it said, I think by the same person, that China once bragged at a climate meeting that they should get credit for the 400 million Chinese who won on the planet due to their one-child policy, but I digress. Well, there are 7.5 million of us around the Salish Sea, and what are the implications for us? The local regional demographers here forecast that by 2040, the equivalent of another Portland is going to nestle in here in this four-county region around Seattle, whether we plan for it or not. There's some who believe that's a gross underestimate, believing that this region will receive a disproportionate share of what people are calling water refugees, people fleeing the drought and heat from other parts of at least our country, as we are modeled to continue to be cooler and wetter than the rest of the nation. Oh, great. How will we think about recovery in a world where the population is growing and geography isn't? How will this Mobius strip of science and policy, informed by your work, help us understand our choices as we grapple with the need to inform the economy to the planets of nature? And to this we add the twin Harold Edwards linked to population growth, and that's climate change, which I would argue, and I think many of you would agree, isn't just a danger. It's the danger in a world littered with immense challenges. Out here in the States, where the challenge of innovation and leadership has been sort of centrifugally flung and fueled, shall we say, by a lack of enthusiasm from our federal partners, and I'm not talking about the EPA, let's talk about Congress or specifically the House if you want to get down to it, as they encourage fossil fuel by underwriting producers with tax incentives worth about $4 billion a year, while the tax credit responsible for a lot of the growth of wind energy, for example, in this country has been allowed to lapse. But we're cautiously optimistic about our ability to change our habits, diversify our notion about who needs to be at the table, and build on the energy and work you see in places all around the Salish Sea. But this one trumps them all, and it will probably take a planetary response. So we remain worried, because our collective response to this seminal challenge, as people keep telling us, will be measured in geologic time. And as we work on the restoration of the resiliency of this great Salish Sea, this international treasure, is it heretical to ask whether it isn't total folly to restore habitat and take down dams, protect eelgrass beds, haul up derelict gear, and manage stormwater with hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer money, while the other climate impact, ocean acidification, also inexorably barrels down on us? We know the ocean chemistry is being altered on a scale it hasn't been seen in 65 million years at least. We used to think that the oceans were a system too big to fail, but this gigantic, seemingly inexhaustible system is being altered in massive ways and at a magnitude and a rate of change species and we will struggle to adapt to. It was on the front page of the Seattle Times just today. How do we muster a response commensurate with the challenge? And in the debate between transition and transformation, as my good friend Casey Golden always says, we have no time for the former, and hopefully it's not too late for the latter. But we do struggle to do either. We seem to live in a world where numbers and even to some extent photos have lost their ability to shock and even move us. Where what Jared Diamond calls landscape amnesia, or shifting baselines, is accelerating as the banality of our growing human footprint leaves mourning for lost diversity and wonder of the natural world to some with the memory of a more stable and bountiful ecosystem. Indigenous peoples as the first rememberers. And leaves the experience of its consequences felt first largely by the vulnerable, often here again, Indigenous peoples. When the recent Gallup poll reveals an American public that has become worried about the threat of global climate, while being often convinced that its significance is being exaggerated by scientists as we watch a global cascade of isolated, predictable, unpredictable, and discrete weather events pile up, less concerned with connecting the dots than with wondering in the moment about when the Inkerman's hip waders are going to fill up with water out on the levee during the second 100-year flood in half a decade. And where climate disruption as an issue moves too slowly to give us that rush of adrenaline that signals emergency, and is so spatially diffused in its causes, it requires enormous collective action on a scale humanity has yet been called on to muster. And in a world where images from the Gulf oil spill, Hurricane Sandy, a flooded downtown Calgary, a waterlogged Great Britain, a burning Australian outback, and the film disintegration of a lovely sea butterfly, and an unstable glacier on Mount Everest, as they powerfully and symbolically contract human suffering and violence and global cataclysm, writ large in a way that seems to inoculate us from the inconvenient and individual truths that are playing out on the grounds of human beings, nations, and creatures who live over there. And when they do move us, sometimes it really is easier, let's be honest, to be outraged by the relentless development and spewing carbon emissions from a coal-fired power plant, say, in Hunan province, than to grapple with the fact that a fifth of those emissions come from creation of products bound for the U.S., or to demand of our legislators that they insist on transparency and safety and sanity from the rail lines and the pipelines and the shipping lines that are on the verge of converging shipments of all manner of fossil fuels, from the viscous bitumens in Alberta to the volatile Bakken Shale from North Dakota, through and on the highway that is the Salish Sea. or to ponder the question of when coal's mined in Montana and shipped out of Washington or Canadian waters and ultimately burned in China, who is responsible for that greenhouse gas? Or to continue to parse the 10 to the minus 6 or 10 to the minus 5th and setting efficient assumption calculus as if the dice on the cancer exposure roulette wheel landed proportionately on all communities. Or, you know, finally, to simply decide to take the bus. What do we take away from all of this? That as policymakers who are informed by science, we need to move beyond the orthodoxy of limits that holds that prosperity, or too much of it anyway, is the cause of, and certainly not the solution to, pollution and degradation. But our narrative of change has to come from another direction. Our work needs to be grounded, yes, in acute scientific expertise, and astute policy aptitude, these binary stars whose gravitational pull support and hold science and policy together. But we have to forge a new vernacular, a new framework of shared values that change our collective expectations about what we can expect from each other, from our neighbor's behavior, as it affects the quality of life today and now several generations. We have to get to an ethic and understanding of what happens to you happens to me in the end, which really is the most conservative of notions, and I think the great occasion for hope. We're a narrative species, as Roger Rosenblatt some years back wrote in an essay about this distinguishing human requirement. What uniquely binds us is our ability, he would argue, our need to tell our story. He suggested that the test of our evolution may lie in getting our story right, coupled with our ability to listen deeply, I would add. So as we publicly, through litigation or electoral politics, consensus, tell our stories and work out our differences or fail to, we are revealing aspects of what constitutes a civil society. We are very lucky to live here. And to the extent that we can get our work done in a way that respects one another, the rule of law and nature's limits will be judged and hopefully celebrated by the men, women, and children that follow us. We have to redefine what prosperity and growth mean in the 21st century and see it as the foundational prologue for the next 100 years. And understand that the human economy is, as they say, a wholly owned subsidiary of the natural environment whose rules we ignore at our peril. So finally, I say to give you some hope that I'm almost finished. What a great good fortune to share with you all this ecoregion, what we call Cascadia, or Salmon Nation, or to paraphrase Tim Egan, any place a salmon can get to, which may be shrinking, but what William Dietrich calls a universe in a mountain cradle, this geographer's delight and sailor's sea. The future citizens of this treasured but troubled water deserve what James Jacobs called a durable prosperity, a resiliency that expresses equally our rights and responsibilities, which we've all been talking about here today, to each other in a world with a reduced caring capacity. 21st century citizenry requires us to make conscious decisions, the big and the small that add up to the public iteration of our privately held beliefs. You can call it conservationism, environmentalism, or just plain good citizenship, or good government. Or to end this ramble on a decidedly non-scientific note and channel the late Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you might simply call it love. Now about Dr. Lagis. I can hear him. Yes, channeling my inner cheerleader. But let's make these decisions together to do the right thing, the big thing, the adult and enduring thing, the thing that's in the public's interest, the planet's interest, which I think in the end is in our self-interest. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. Have a great 2.5 more days.